You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
I hope you've had a chance to get some coffee, and we're going to get started. I'm Ted Pacone. I'm a senior fellow with the Latin America Initiative here at the Brookings Foreign Policy Program. And we're here today to talk about a subject that I can tell from the audience you know pretty well. It's been an issue around for a long time, going back to, well, decades really, but a time that I was very involved with in the 1990s when I worked in the Clinton administration on some of these issues. But obviously we've come to a key turning point with the signing of the peace accords between the government of Colombia and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC. And we're now at a stage where the two sides and all the various actors in between are trying to figure out how to implement various facets of the accords. And today we're going to focus in particular on the section of the peace accords regarding the drug problem, which is one of the most vexing problems that Colombia has faced for so many years and has been central to U.S.-Colombia relations as well. So we will get into several aspects of this issue, the complexities, the changes in demand and supply that we're seeing in most recent couple of years, and how this is going to be addressed through the government program. And of course, with some changes here in Washington, with the incoming Trump administration, what impact that will have in the months to come. And for this discussion, we have three of the really best experts I can think of to talk about this issue. And we'll start with Adam Isaacson, a senior associate with the Washington Office on Latin America, who's been working on these issues for probably over two decades, previously at the Center for International Policy. And I really encourage you to read his ongoing blog work on these topics. He'll give us a sense of the current state of play in the peace accords. We'll then turn to my colleague, Vonda Felbob Brown, who's a senior fellow with our Latin America Initiative and our Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. Vonda is a prolific author on several facets of illicit economies around the world, whether it's poppy growing in Afghanistan and Myanmar, or wildlife trafficking in Indonesia. She has two books coming out soon. One is on wildlife trafficking called The Extinction Market, and the other one called Narco Noir, Mexico's Cartels, Cops, and Corruption. And she will also address some of these issues, including from a comparative perspective. And then we will hear from Bo Kilmer, who is co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center and a senior policy researcher and professor with Pardee RAND Graduate School. Bo's done a lot of work on public health and public safety as it relates to drug problems, including issues around legalization of marijuana, but has also been looking closely at the latest dynamics of the cocaine problem in the United States. We will have a little discussion afterwards, and then we'll open it up to Q&A, and I look forward to your participation. Adam.
Well, thank you, Ted, and thank you, Vonda. Thank you for putting this together. It's great. We haven't had enough opportunities to have a conversation like this, and thank you all for coming, too, because there is a lot to talk about. You know, the numbers are pretty grim. The United States, and whether you believe the United States figure, which is about 180,000 to 88,000 hectares of coca grown in Colombia last year, or the UN figure with about 96,000 growing to 2015, the trend lines are the same. They're showing a large increase in coca cultivation around Colombia. And if you go to Colombia, rural Colombia, where a lot of this is grown, and it is the same regions as it always has been, it hasn't expanded into new areas, the coca is really easy to find. Once again, it is growing up to the roadside or the riverside in these areas where there really aren't a lot of roads. It's most of the time when you see it, it's about knee high because the planting has been often quite recent. Colombia's interdictions are breaking records. Last year, the Colombian forces got 379 metric tons of cocaine just in Colombia's land and territorial waters. The previous record was about 250. And one thing that you are seeing in a lot of areas is that growers are planting it in almost as an insurance policy. You will often, in areas that have had alternative development and have been semi-inserted into the national economy, you'll often find a grower typically who has 10 or 15 hectares of several crops. They'll have cacao, they'll have plantains or something else, but there'll maybe be one or two hectares of coca in between. And you'll the explanation is often, these other crops, some of them are probably giving us more money than coca right now. But they go like this, they fluctuate wildly, and you never know whether we're gonna actually lose money or make money. Coca is above average, it's never the best price, but it's always a steady income, and you can always count on it, perhaps because you know the price is rather fixed by the way the market looks. Now, I mean, this increase in coca growing really got started around 2013, and really for several reasons. And one of them that you hear a lot inside the U.S. government is because aerial herbicide fumigation stopped. It had been actually declining steadily year after year for every year since 2007. And for most of that decline, from 2007 until about 2013, coca was also declining, perhaps for several reasons, because there had been more manual eradication, because there had been more of an effort to get a government presence into a lot of conflictive areas, because the price of gold was really high, and serving illicit mining was acting almost as the most effective alternative development program that Colombia had ever seen, and a couple of other factors. So even as fumigation was declining for most of those years, coca was also reducing to levels Colombia hadn't seen in 20 years. Why was it declining? One reason was what they call Colombianization. The United States, as planned, Colombia began to wind down, was handing over more and more budgetary and other responsibilities to the Colombian government to take over the eradication program. It's expensive. And Colombia did not want to pay for the 170,000 hectares a year that the United States had been funding the spraying of circa 2006-2007. Also, the FARC, we don't know why, but all of us, there have been years without any planes getting shot down. Then the FARC shot down two planes in 2013 within a few months of each other, which forced a reevaluation of the spray program. And then, of course, in early 2015, the World Health Organization came out with a study, sort of a literature review, indicating that the chemical used in the herbicide mixture, glyphosate, Roundup, made by Monsanto, could possibly cause cancer. And that forced sort of a critical mass within the Colombian government to suspend the aerial spraying program, which it finally was suspended in October of 2015. Another factor is that manual eradication also slowed down. In 2007, I believe it was, 2008, the Colombian government paid for the manual eradication of 90,000 hectares, forcibly, of coca around the country. By last year, it was down to 18,000, and it's costly to do this. It costs even more to bring eradicators to a coca-growing area in a helicopter and protect them. It's also super dangerous. A couple hundred eradicators, or more often the police and soldiers who are guarding them, have been killed or injured by snipers, by ambushes, by booby traps and landmines. Now, forced eradication decreasing on its own is not necessarily a bad thing. But to do it, it needs to be accompanied by a huge effort to do something else, namely an effort to get the root causes of why people in ungoverned parts of Colombia, virtually abandoned by their state, feel themselves compelled to grow coca. But unfortunately, during these last few years of reduced eradication, little to nothing was done to replace eradication. Even the UNODC has documented a decline, because of budgetary pressures mainly, but a decline in funding for even alternative development programs in rural Colombia. This was not helped by the fact that the price of gold, which was spiked after the financial crisis, began to go back down, making coca once more an attractive option. Colombia's peso got very weak, going from 2,000 to the dollar to 3,000 to the dollar, which meant that the farm gate price for coca leaf stayed about the same in dollar terms, but that in coca terms, it began to look much more attractive, roughly 2 million pesos per kilo of coca leaf to about 3 million, which maybe had incentivized more people to grow coca. And then the peace accord. In 2014, the government and FARC arrived at a draft accord for dealing with what they called the solution to the problem of illicit drugs. It proposed a scheme or a plan in which coca growers would be offered incentives. They'd be offered money as well as help with productive projects to wean themselves off of coca. That became public, the text of that became public as a draft in 2014. It therefore created a perverse incentive for people to, hey, grow some coca so that you, when there is a peace accord, you can be among those who benefit. And that may be one reason why the coca is so often knee-high. There was also probably in some zones, and I can't confirm this, but there seemed to be an unwillingness to crack down really hard on coca growers in areas of sort of historic FARC dominance. If there were a lot of, you know, bringing in the riot police to fight against people who are resisting coca growing with injuries, with outbreaks of violence, that would have probably affected the dynamic at the table in Havana. But ultimately, aerial spraying, contrary to what you often hear, was not stopped or banned or suspended because of the peace accord. In fact, the text of the peace accord, the Colombian government insisted, still holds open the possibility of spraying in the future. It says so explicitly in the language. But aerial spraying, in our view, is a bad option because it only addresses one of many causes, and I just went over several, of this recent spike in coca growing. And yet again, we're talking about ungoverned areas where, you know, sending a spray plane overhead doesn't really change the dynamic economically on the ground. Now, with the peace accord that was signed, finally ratified last November, December, the Colombian government has a plan that is sort of unlike anything Colombia has really tried before. But for the most part, that's all it is right now. It's a plan and a set of promises. It's promising, but we have to wait. There's two chapters of the peace accord that are relevant here. The first is chapter one on rural development, or integral rural reform, they call it. The FARC did not win, they were not strong enough, they did not win a land reform with actual redistribution of property in the countryside, but they did get an accord that commits the government over the next 15 years to making a lot more investments in state presence and in basic services and public goods in rural areas that have often hardly seen any. It's a large, sweeping, fundamental accord when you really read through it. They commit the government to performing a national cadastre, mapping out all land holdings around the country, massive land titling, handing out of baldíos, or state lands that are currently not being used, a lot of tertiary road building, farm-to-market roads, access to credit, education, health programs, food security programs, electrification, irrigation, and much more. It's a long list, and it would be expensive. The accords commit the government to spending 15 years setting all of this in place. And, you know, it's a reasonable estimate that carrying this accord out would cost a few $1 billion a year to do. This first chapter is probably dollar for dollar the most expensive part of the peace accord to comply with. It really hasn't started implementation yet. The laws to implement it still have to be passed. Now, the other chapter of the accord that is directly relevant to this is the fourth chapter, the solution to the problem of illicit drugs, or it often uses the phrase crop substitution. The idea here is to sign agreements with coca-growing households and communities around the country, committing these communities to voluntarily eradicating their coca in exchange for a set of services tailored to them. The way these have gone so far, with roughly 38,000 families signing on already, is that in exchange for eradicating coca, it's kind of transactional. You'll get about 36 million pesos, $12,000 roughly, over 2 years to set up productive projects to insert into the legal economy. Well, you get other community services as well alongside that. The estimated cost of this over the next 2 years is about $550 million. Now, these families and households must verifiably get rid of their coca, sort of fudging whether they have to do it immediately or not. But they have to get rid of it, and if they do get rid of their coca within about 2 years, they'll be on a fast track to getting a land title. Those who the government believes are cheating on this will be kicked out of the program and will be subject to forced eradication. And in some areas, it may be actually ex-FARC who are carrying out the eradication. Now, it's easy to envision scenarios here where both sides accuse the other of noncompliance with this agreement. There's already accusations from some coca-growing communities of bad faith or poor coordination, with eradicators coming in already before, you know, households even had a chance to have any income source. Now, this section of the accord is not really, I wouldn't call it a new model, really. I think the first chapter is more of a new model, but even this has not been tried on this scale before in Colombia. Now, the plan for this year, President Juan Manuel Santos has said that the plan is to eradicate 100,000 hectares of coca in Colombia. Again, as I said, up from 18,000 last year. The idea is to eradicate 50,000 hectares through these voluntary agreements, which may be gradual. It could take more than into next year to eradicate those 50,000. And then another 50,000 through forced manual eradication. This is in areas where perhaps what the coca growing is considered industrial, the plots are too big, or they're growing in national parks where they shouldn't be growing, or maybe in indigenous reserves, you have colonos, and the eradicators will just come in and offer nothing in return. Now, if the government even gets some of that amount, if they eradicate half of that or two-thirds of that, I think that the numbers next year, when the United States comes out with its estimate, UNODC comes out with this, they'll show a reduction for 2017. Not a permanent reduction, but maybe enough of a reduction to give the Colombian government some breathing room to keep trying this new approach without a lot of pressure coming from Washington and elsewhere to keep eradicating. But ultimately, we don't know what president and what party is going to take over in Colombia. There's elections in May of next year, and the new president will take over 2018, whoever that is. We don't know whether that's going to be someone who's willing to fulfill these commitments and continue what was started in the Accords, or somebody who wants to favor the old large landholder model in the countryside and as best as they can ignore the commitments in the first accord. The Rural Development Accord, that first chapter, is crucial, but it's shaky. It costs a lot at a time when Colombia's budget is declining. There aren't a lot of voters in the countryside, to speak crassly. Colombia is now a largely urban country, and there's not that much appetite, perhaps, to pay billions of dollars in taxes for rural areas. Large landowners in Colombia have a lot of political clout. But still, if Colombia can get the first accord going, I think it would be transformational. The countryside would become a much less hospitable place for growing coca. The fourth chapter, these agreements with the families, I don't think it can really succeed without the first one really being in place, because eventually, if it's just a crop substitution program in a vacuum, the checks stop being written at some point, and then what? Now, just a note about what's up here in Washington. The United States government, looking at this trend of coca growing, is being pulled in two directions. Look, the prospect of a long-term solution to Colombia's coca problem has appeal here in Washington. There are, even in the more conservative elements of the Trump administration, there is interest in having the FARC taken off the table as an actor generating violence and generating coca. So there's still support for the framework of the peace accords. But the increase in coca, the increase in cocaine production is creating a lot of political pressure here for a harder line. There is concern, and Bo's going to talk about this, about use here in the United States of cocaine. There's concern about more cocaine entering Central America and Mexico, destabilizing things there, the Caribbean too. And frankly, I think many people in this city, again, speaking crassly, they doubt the Colombian government's capacity or commitment to actually create a functioning government presence in all corners of the national territory. Colombia is starting to get a reputation for announcing detailed plans, often bringing up a bunch of well-trained people with London School of Economics degrees who speak English better than me, who come with a big PowerPoint presentation saying what they're going to do, but then several years later that doesn't get done. If it's a military effort, it has a better chance of getting done because it's more well-funded, more popular politically. But a lot of the governance on strategies never seem to get fulfilled. And when you think about it, if the United States insists on fumigation, that is an implicit or tacit vote of no confidence in the Colombian government's ability to bring a presence to its countryside. It's a sense that there's not a real belief that the Colombian government will be able to do what it says in the first accord and have a government presence on the ground. My whole point, though, here is that there's no choice. The Colombian government has to have a functioning presence on the ground in these areas. Otherwise, we're going to be doing this forever, and we'll be having the same discussion in 20 years. For the 23 years of herbicide fumigation, the Colombian government made only modest progress in getting into the ungoverned parts of the area. A handy excuse for this, of course, was that the FARC were there. There was no way to get here there without having to shoot your way in first. Well, the FARC are gone now. So what is Colombia going to do? Just as a postscript, even if a pro-fumigation president is elected next year in Colombia and they want to reinstate the herbicide spraying program, don't expect a huge jump in spraying right away. It's not like they're going to start spraying 100,000 hectares. Colombia probably won't be able to afford it. I mean, restarting a program like that is very expensive, and it's not clear that there's going to be money in the foreign aid budget here. But we can talk about the foreign aid budget later.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Ada, and we will come back to that. Vanda.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much, Adam, for this excellent setup. I want to, focus a little bit on some of the politics of coca eradication and to sort of give away my punchline right at the beginning, which is to say that big push to eradicate might well jeopardize many of the core aspects of the peace deal that gives Colombia hope. namely the buy-in of the local population that the state for once will not mistreat them again. And even if the government can muscle the post-peace FARC into going along with eradication that is now justified in terms of the peace package, that still can nonetheless cause the population to be alienated from the government. And let's remember that FARC is not the only armed actor. There are bandas criminales, there is ELN, there will be potentially new actors. And so there is now big pressure in the United States and big pressure on the Colombian government not to put up with the increases in coca cultivation that can, in fact, undermine the very opportunity to get at the root causes that are crucial. I also want to preface, though, that alternative livelihoods, and I will speak more about that in my talk, don't have a good record in eliminating cultivation of illicit drugs. Often because they are poorly implemented, and in fact, I am quite concerned about some of the elements of the current setup that the government is talking about. How that drug deal is handled has also big implication for FARC's long-term behavior. So right now, the Colombian government and the FARC are implementing this joint plan, and the FARC is presumably on board. But I would make the argument that one of the things that pushed the FARC toward the negotiated peace deal were the 2012-2013 Cocalero protests that the FARC did not instigate. The original accusation, the reaction from President Santos and the Colombian government was to dismiss the Cocalero protests and say that they are just organized by the FARC. In fact, the FARC was very much caught off guard as to how much the Cocaleros, the traditionally suppressed countryside, could engage in political mobilization that in some ways looked like Cocaleros in Bolivia, something the Cocaleros in Colombia never really did. And it was the FARC was jumping on the bandwagon, only subsequently realizing that if they stay out of this, they will lose their core constituency. And to the extent that the FARC has any political future, it is to deliver to the marginalized, repressed, heavily Cocalero countryside. So if the FARC starts supporting programs such as aggressive eradication now that the peace deal has been signed, it's really eliminating the only viable political base that gives it some political future. And so 4 years down the road, we might see the FARC starting to think very differently about what it did. And issues of unity, cohesion, sticking to the agreements might well arise. And you know, that's an element that we don't often hear about in the discussion of COCA, but something that needs to come into the calculations of what is ultimately the more crucial precondition. Not just the ceasefire, but viable peace, including peace in the social sense, or immediate satisfaction of driving COCA numbers down. Adam prefaced some of the immediate plans for this next year, next 2 years, with 50,000 hectares of coca to be eradicated through forced eradication and 50,000 through voluntary agreements. I personally believe that those are extraordinarily ambitious numbers that have rarely been achieved anywhere in the world, that have often been achieved only through very heavy repression, and that are, in fact, setting up the Colombian government for failure. And failed in two ways. Either the Colombian government will, in fact, drive those numbers in the first year, but I question the viability and sustainability, or it will not achieve those numbers and will then be subject to claims that it failed by its own standards. So I think that there was a real risk and not a wise risk to put those numbers forth. Nonetheless, we are there. So what hides behind those numbers? Well, so far about 60,000 families, 58,000 families have signed up for the voluntary agreement, and that's already coming close to matching that 50,000 hectares. In many ways, the core basis of the voluntary agreement matches previous efforts at alternative livelihoods in Colombia, and they have systematically failed. They have often operated, sometimes driven by the United States, but often internally driven, on the premise that a community needs to eradicate all coca for the community to qualify for assistance. In this case, there seems to be somewhat more allowance for individual family decisions and somewhat less insistence that if someone in the community starts violating, that precludes the community from receiving assistance. But in its basis, it's still the essential bargain. You community, you village, eradicate all coca, and then you get a certain amount of compensation. The big difference in the current package is the scale of the compensation, where it used to be a few hundred dollars per year. Now you're looking at almost 8,000 in the first year, perhaps amounting to 12,000 over the 2 years. And as Adam mentioned, there seems to be some wiggle room for the speed with which the coca is eradicated. That is good. I would in fact posit that some of the most successful cases of alternative development come from areas where there is not an initial insistence of eradicating the illegal crop to start with, because alternative livelihoods never materialize at the speed that eradication can materialize, even self-eradication of the coca can materialize. The scale of the package is also significant. The most previous model, most dominant previous model of in Colombia was the Guarda Bosque program, where the eradication was taking place in national park. In my view, very wise choice. That would be also my priority for eradication. But where the scheme ran in a very similar ways, the community eradicated coca that qualified the community for getting assistance. That amounted to several hundred dollars per family. That initially led the family to keep chickens, perhaps get some rabbits, perhaps get some other protein. And a year from now, the family realized that they were just economically not capable of continuing. So it was almost just immediate food assistance. The current package is bigger than immediate food assistance. But I also question dumping $8,000 onto a family that is disconnected from any viable market, that does not have a road, that is not plugged to value-added chains. And indeed, it is the value-added chains and infrastructure, and infrastructure not just roads, but infrastructure such as in processing plant, that's been the Achilles heel of alternative livelihoods in Colombia. You know, some of the best programs with most effort were in Nariño, one of the very contested, very violent, very difficult areas. But for a while, at least 7 years, there was enormous dedication to make alternative livelihoods in places like Tumaco and other areas work. And they always died because there was no processing plant, so the villages, Afro-Colombians, would switch to cultivating cacao, the most frequent thing that people in Colombia love to direct cocaleros to. And 4 years later, the cacao might have started producing pods, but no one was coming there to grind it into chocolate, no one was coming there to take it. There was some effort to make Cauca, Cali supermarkets to dedicate a percentage of their purchases to that area. It really struggled. And without value-added chains, there was just tremendous disappointments. And despite a lot of commitment and hard work by local officials, there is little to show for the effort. And the current narrative in Colombia really doesn't, in my view, focus on the value-added chains processing capacity sufficiently. Now, the preoccupation is with chasing the replacement crop. And again, I would posit that it's not the right preoccupation, nor is the less than zero, but essentially zero coca underlying concept underneath. So, what has worked? I want to direct you to a very significant thing that Adam said, that farmers cultivate a chunk of their land as an insurance policy. And I would suggest that this chunk of the land should not be a priority for eradicating, that we should give farmers a scope of living with that chunk of land. We can debate whether it's 1 hectare, 2 hectares, half an hectare. But learning here from Bolivia and the UNOCATO policy there might be well appropriate. Bolivia is not an easy place in Washington to suggest to learn from it, and I have many problems with many aspects of President Morales' policies. But the sense that you allow farmers to have some cushion, at least for a while, until alternative livelihoods pan out, I think is well worth replicating. Then, however, we need to think about how do you get in the long term past that cushion. And the most successful case is Thailand. It is the only country that ever eliminated its production of illegal crops through alternative livelihoods. It took 30 years of effort. I'll highlight some of the elements of it. I also want to drive that the conditions were extremely auspicious in several ways. At the peak of cultivation, we had about 18,000 hectares of poppy, so one-tenth of the numbers in Afghanistan, one-tenth of the numbers in Colombia. So it's much easier to achieve success on that scale. Nonetheless, what were the key elements of success? Well, one was to suspend eradication during insurgency years, during conflict, but also to suspend eradication in the initial post-conflict years. The farmers were told that eradication would come, but they were told we will work with you for 5 years, 8 years. In some cases, it took much longer than that to switch the family and the village to other crops. So, and that was well known. The government, the Royal Foundation, was putting that policy forward. Precisely because there was a sense that you make people eradicate early on, which Thailand did try to do, everyone becomes soured and the alternative livelihoods will not materialize quickly. Initially, the focus was again on chasing the replacement crop, and it was cabbage, it was apricots, it was a variety of crops. Later on, there was realization that diversification of the crops is crucial, that if everyone is directed to the same crop, it was a prescription for disaster. But more importantly, it was crucial to move to off-farm products. And so other elements of development and employment and job creation were part of it. Moreover, there was also significant recognition that one had to get the largest structural precondition in terms of social development, human development in first. So one of the first things that started being done was that the minority, the Hmong and some of the Wa and other minorities that were cultivating poppy would be given citizenship. They would be given land titles prior to eradicating poppy. So again, I am very uncomfortable with this bargain. You will get the land title only after you eradicate your coca. I think it has many pitfalls, both normative and importantly, practical. And there was a lot of effort to bring in some basic education, basic health care into those villages. Now, I would say that the condition of many cocaleros in Colombia are better than the condition of many of the hill tribes that cultivated Thailand. I mean, in some of the hill areas, we're really talking about a level of underdevelopment that is even greater than in Colombia. But it's hardly uniformly the case in Colombia. And so it was this combination of persistence, steady dedication of money, unwavering dedication of money, unwavering commitment of the royal family that had much to do with the deceased king, and without whose steadfast support it might not have pulled out, the willingness to wait 30 years, good partnerships such as with the German Development Agency, and crucially, in the sort of key success years of the 1990s, and late 1980s, Thailand was one of the East Asian tigers. And what it meant was a lot of income generation, but a lot of job generation. And although the poppy cultivating villages could not plug in to the industrialization and movement of people from rural areas into urban areas, those jobs that were vacated by the lowland Thai populations were then agricultural spaces into which the hill communities could move. They did not literally move, but they could start cultivating, moving into jobs that others have abandoned. And were it not for that, I doubt that we would have seen the success. So it was major structural changes in the Thai economy that allowed success under very auspicious conditions. And it is these major changes, structural changes in Colombia that we also need to see. It will always be pushing the stone uphill if Colombia continues to tax its land minimally and its labor very much, which will always produce the growth that we have seen in Colombia, even under the best of times with strong growth. It's growth that creates money but doesn't create jobs, doesn't create opportunities, because it might cost as little as 50 cents to pay yearly taxes on a hectare of land, mm-hmm. which lands yields to fallow land, unproductive land. That requires that the Colombian state, Colombian people, take on the vested interests and the basic, still highly exclusionary arrangements of the Colombian society. And the peace deal speaks about inclusion. The language is magnificent in the 300-page document. Now, will it be implemented? Will we see meaningful changes in taxation that will get on the vested interests? It's something that people of the current government were committed to, but were not able to deliver. Adam talked about fancy PowerPoints and detailed plans. Well, one of the reasons why the peace negotiation came about is that the built phase of counterinsurgency, of what was known as the consolidation plan, and had later on several other names, just died with vested interest, Ministry of Agriculture, other ministry just refusing to do what the government asked them to do. And so the rural areas were cleared of FARC, were cleared of violence, but continue to fester. And that was the impetus for then moving into different negotiation. So that conflict with the vested interest, with the powerful groups, including in the agricultural sectors that benefit, still needs to take place. And if they don't, then it will be just constant buyout. Here is some coca eradicated. Here is a little bit of money. Coca goes back up. Here is a little bit of money. I want to conclude by saying that one of the tough things for the government is to, I think, make hard prioritization choices. Right now, the program is such that anyone who wants to volunteer to be part of the agreement can. That doesn't make sense because, as I said, dumping a ton of money into some remote Magdalena Medio area might improve the family's condition by having more money, but it's also unviable. So we can focus on areas that are closer to roads, where there is some potential of moving investors in, where there is some potential for value-added chains, and steadily expanding the circle, the infamous ink spot, to borrow the coin terminology. But just there are some parts of Colombia that will never have anything that's legally viable. And those should be the last to tackle. There are areas where legal economies can take off and produce viable income. Those should be the priority areas. My very last point, I think it's very important that Colombia also thinks about its alternative development in terms of its environmental impact. A lot of environmental development directly or indirectly leads to not just greater gold mining, but also very significant deforestation. Right. We have already been seeing it in Colombia. We are acutely seeing it in Bolivia and Peru. That was the outcome in Myanmar. That was the outcome also in Thailand, even with all the success and wise design in Thailand. And it would be great if Colombia could try to avoid that.
Great. Thank you. You touched on many different complex facets of the problem. It's interesting to hear about the Thailand example. Bring us back to the United States and talk about the demand side of the equation here.
Sure. Well, I'll cut to the chase. At this point, we don't have solid evidence about what's happened recently with total cocaine consumption in the United States. And there are three reasons for that. One, we just have data lags. Two, we eliminated the data program that provided the most information about illegal drug markets in the United States, and that's the ADAM program. The Arrested Drug Abuse Monitoring Program was cut in 2013. And that has implications beyond just talking about the cocaine trade. And the third complicating factor here is actually the opioid crisis. But before I get into these specifics, I want to step back a little bit and talk about 2006 to 2010. A couple of years ago, I led the effort for ONDCP to estimate the total size of the cocaine market in the United States going from 2000 all the way to 2010. And we documented that between 2006 to 2010, the total amount of pure cocaine consumed in the United States dropped by about 50%. I mean, this was unprecedented. It was from somewhere right around 300 metric tons down to about 150. Now, there's a lot of debate about, well, what caused that drop? Now, on the supply side, you have some people arguing that it was stepped up efforts, interdiction efforts within Colombia. Some have argued that it was precursor controls here in the United States. Others have talked about that it was manual eradication, because I think it was in 2004, they only manually eradicated, 6,000 hectares, and then it went up to 90,000. So there's some people that kind of think it's more on the supply side. But then on the demand side, some will argue, well, that maybe some of that cocaine was actually just was more likely to be going to Argentina and to Brazil and to Europe. People talk about the aging out of the heavy cocaine users here in the United States. Also with the recession, people may not have had as much money. So there's really no consensus about what really drove what's arguably one of the biggest successes in modern drug history. But we really don't know what caused it. One hypothesis is it might have just been a perfect storm. They had a bunch of different activities and interventions happening, and that the combined effect actually had you saw a larger decrease than you would have if each of them had happened separately. It's kind of a perfect storm argument. I mean, this is very much an empirical question. Now let's go back to today. And a couple of months ago, the U.S. State Department released the International Narcotics Control Strategy report, and it had two different lines about cocaine use in the United States. One of the lines said that cocaine use was decreasing in the U.S., but then there was another line that talked about that there were troubling early signs of an actual increase in cocaine use in the United States. The Washington Post then used that latter quote, combined it with information about new initiates in the United States, and also combined it with new information about cocaine-related overdose deaths, and it had the headline, American cocaine use is way up. But a month before that, the National Institute on Drug Abuse had posted that they'd acknowledged that there had been this increase in cocaine-related overdoses in the United States, but that cocaine use was decreasing. So what's really happening here? So with my colleague Greg Majette at RAND, we kind of looked at some of the stuff we had done for ONDCP before, and we tried projecting out and kind of updating all of the figures for those data sets where the data still exists. And so when we think about total consumption, we think about the heavy users. It's the heavy users that drive the market. So when we look at treatment indicators, so we look at the number of individuals who are going to publicly funded treatment for where cocaine is the primary substance, that's gone down dramatically. At one point it was well over 200,000, and now it's, at least in 2014, it was right around 80, 90,000. So you saw this big decrease. But those are the most recent data we actually have about treatment nationally in the United States. So it's, May of 2017, and the best national data we have on that is through 2014. Also, with the Arrestee Drug Abuse Monitoring Program, which I said was a really successful data program, and that at its height, they were getting information from arrestees in 40 different counties throughout the United States, not only asking them about their drug use patterns, but also getting information about how much money they were spending, where they were getting the drugs from. And then at the end of the survey, at the end of the interview, they would actually ask them to submit to a drug test. And it had nothing to do with our case. Most of them did it. So we actually had pretty good information. And so, yeah, at its height, around 2002, 2003, we had about 40,000 arrestees surveyed each year. The program was funded by the Department of Justice. It was cut in 2003. ONDCP realized that this was an important data set to have, so they were able to cobble together some funds to bring back. So it was ADAM 2, came back in 2007. They were only focusing on 10 counties then. Money ran out. They could only focus on 5 for a few years. And then the program was terminated in 2013. But if we just kind of look at the data through 2013 there, it seems to be pretty flat between 2010 to 2013. It may have gone down and may have been a little bit of a spike up, but overall it looks pretty flat. If we look at information about workplace drug testing from Quest Diagnostics, it looks like the share of those who were taking tests that were testing positive for cocaine was pretty flat. So for some of the indicators that we associate with heavy use, it seemed to either be flat or kind of going down. But it's interesting, when we go to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which is administered each year. We survey 70,000 people, and you know, you get to a nationally representative picture of what's happening in the United States. We definitely, since 2010, there's been about a 50% increase in the number of new users here in the United States. And over that time, there's between 2010 and 2015, there's about a 25% increase in the number of past month users. Now, that's informative, but that's not necessarily a great proxy for total consumption, right? I mean, the national survey is great for getting information about initiation and information about marijuana, but when you start talking about your heavy cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine users, that's not where you go. You go to the ADAM program, which was cut. But what was interesting is that between 2010 and 2015, the number of cocaine-related overdose deaths increased 50%. And this was a bit of a puzzle to me, because we had done all that work kind of showing it going down, and then I started seeing, you know, you would see it start ticking back up, but there were no indications that heavy use was going up, and so I wasn't quite sure what was happening until a paper was just published in the American Journal of Public Health just a couple months ago, and they attribute the entire increase in cocaine-related deaths to the opioids. And so is that they said it was primarily heroin and the synthetic opioids that are driving this increase. And so it's really interesting. So part of the argument is that you just had some polysubstance users. Those were using cocaine and heroin. Heroin now is becoming much more dangerous because of the fentanyl in it, so people are just more likely to overdose. They also argue that there was an increase in the number of individuals who are using both cocaine and heroin. But what's most disturbing is you're now seeing reports that people are using cocaine that actually is laced with fentanyl. And it's not only happening here in the United States, it's also happening in Canada. I was just up there for a conference, and I was talking to the head of narcotics, I think, for Toronto. They're saying that a lot of the cocaine that they're seeing is laced with fentanyl. And people don't know it, and a number of them will overdose, and you know, not everyone who overdoses dies, but a significant share do. So this, so when we kind of look at this, yeah, you see this increase, but what I did with my colleague is we separated out deaths. We looked at, let's look at total deaths, and sure enough, you see that 50% increase. But if we look at total cocaine-related deaths that where there were no opioids involved, flat over the entire period. Really interesting. So the takeaway is, so while we have no evidence about kind of what's happening with total consumption here in the United States over the past, you know, since 2013, we have to pay attention to those initiation figures. You know, I said they increased 50% from 2010 to 2015. So that means in 2015, you had about 1 million people who self-reported that they'd used cocaine for the first time. And most of them will try it once or twice. They won't run into any problems. But there's an off-cited study from the early 2000s which suggests that of anyone who tries cocaine, between 15 to 16% of them are likely to experience or become dependent on the drug within the next 10 years. Now, I'm not sure if that number still holds up. I mean, this is a fairly old study. But if that's the case, if we had 1 million new users in 2015, that means we're going to see 150,000 people who are going to, within the next 10 years, experience, suffer from a clinical disorder. And so this is something I think we need to pay really close attention to. And so when we think about what we could do domestically, I have kind of four recommendations. One, we shouldn't take any actions which would reduce the availability of substance use treatment in the United States. That's number one. Number two is that we actually should increase the availability of substance use treatment here in the United States. Three, we need to pay close attention to this link between cocaine and fentanyl. And this is where we need public health authorities, you know, to begin doing lots of tests of cocaine that they're seizing or if they see a lot of overdoses in places where you don't necessarily have a large heroin problem. Because this is a big concern. People need to know that if they're going to be using cocaine, that if there's fentanyl in the community, they're at risk for an overdose death. And the fourth recommendation I would have is bring back that arrested drug abuse monitoring program. I mean, at its peak, it was about $10 million. We pretty much spend about $50 million a year on the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. And at a time, here we're talking about cocaine. You know, we're spending a lot of time talking about what's happening with heroin consumption, what's happening with the prescription opioids. I mean, that was the best source of information we had about what was happening on the ground, and we cut it. So this is a time when we need data to kind of inform these discussions. So I would urge, you know, Department of Justice, National Institute of Health, but also foundations, pharmaceutical companies. I mean, there's a way we can find $10 million a year to make this happen, because I really think it could help us learn more about what's happening and hopefully prevent some of these deaths in the future.
Great. Wow. Thank you, Bo. I mean, by the way, there's some seats up in the front if anyone wants to sit down while we continue the discussion. I mean, this story about the data collection, you know, for researchers and how challenging that is, and for policymakers, if we don't have good data to make some decisions, it's really alarming. I have a question for each of you as follow-up, slightly different, but relate to your talks. Adam, I want you to say a little bit more. You know, we had President Santos come last year with President Obama and talk about the movement toward Paz Colombia, and from Plan Colombia to Paz Colombia, and the U.S. contribution to implementation of the peace accords, and some real questions being raised now about whether the Trump administration will follow through on those commitments, and what are the views in Congress toward this issue? It seems to me quite important if the U.S. is committed as much as the Colombian government is or is not. But in some sense, there needs to be some serious infusion of international resources, and we have a lot at stake given the investment we've already made. Vanda, for you, I want to, at the crux of the problem here has always been about state presence and capacity in such a vast, complex country. And you got to that towards the end about, you know, prioritize. But you also have a vacuum that's going to be created as demobilization occurs. Can you say a little bit more about the organized crime factors, the paramilitaries who might take advantage as this implementation goes forward? And then can you say, Bo, a little bit more about why did these budget cuts happen on the data collection? Do you see any hope seriously for restoring that money given the politics around our budget right now? And then I don't know if you're looking at other demand factors around the world. You mentioned Canada, you mentioned South America and Europe. Is it rising, and what impact could that have bringing it back to Colombia? So even if the U.S., let's say the U.S. demand continues to be rather flat, but it's growing elsewhere, who's going to supply that cocaine? We talked before coming in about Peru. Can you say a little bit about those issues? Adam.
Thanks, Ted. Just for context, about 10 years ago, at the height of the implementation of Plan Colombia, U.S. assistance to Colombia exceeded $700 million a year. And about $600 million of that went toward military offensives, police efforts, eradication, interdiction. The rest was sort of what we would consider economic or humanitarian aid. That steadily declined over the years. By 2015, we were down to about $320 million a year in assistance to Colombia, just over half of that for military police eradication. The idea when President Santos visited last February and President Obama announced a new aid package for Colombia called Peace Colombia was to go from that 320 level up to about 450, with most of that increase being economic assistance, efforts to increase state presence in the countryside, more money for victims, more money for demining, helping the military reorient its doctrine, et cetera. That Peace Colombia package passed separately, the House and the Senate. Republican majority, no problem. In fact, the House increased the amount. But then, of course, we didn't have a 2017 foreign aid bill. We may, by the end of this week, your guess is as good as mine. We are right now in a one-week continuing resolution. There may be an omnibus appropriation that includes a new state and foreign operations bill. There has been no effort that I know of in the Trump administration to try to whack back that Peace Colombia request for 2017. That money, as far as I know, is still in there. But again, it could be taken out at 3 in the morning on Wednesday without any of us knowing. But my guess is that they're going to get it. What worries me more is 2018, we already know that the Trump administration wants to cut worldwide foreign aid by about 29 or 30%. We know that on the USAID programs, thanks to a document that Foreign Policy Magazine leaked a week ago, they want to cut foreign economic support funds and development assistance global health programs to Latin America by 39%, with about 21% of Colombia being cut from 2016 levels, not from the putative increase in 2017. So it would be a deep cut for Colombia in the kind of assistance it would need to implement that first accord to help victims and other things. Now, that cut probably won't survive Congress in 2018. I think, as a lot of folks, including Republicans in the Senate and House, have said, that cut would be dead on arrival, in the words of Lindsey Graham, who appropriates this sort of thing in the Senate. But even if it's half as much of a cut or one-third as much of a cut, it would be devastating for Colombia's effort to implement. Colombia, obviously, most of the money to implement will have to come from Colombia, but in terms of a U.S. show of support, it would be a very bad sign. Now, just the factions, or the tendencies in the Congress right now, first of all, the Trump administration has said almost nothing, and they don't have the personnel in place, really, to have had much of a sense of where they're headed on this. So far, they've been vaguely supportive, and I think hopefully President Santos and President Trump will have a meeting in the next month and a half or so to nail this down a bit more. But in Congress, the Democratic Party continues to be pretty solidly behind the Peace Colombia framework. Key Republican leaders, appropriators, chairmen of the Foreign Affairs and Foreign Relations Committees tend to be supportive, but are voicing a lot of concern about the increase in coca growing. Some voice concern also about non-extradition of FARC members, at least those who have been involved in kidnapping or killing citizens. So they're shakier, but they still are generally realizing that, you know, this is the better path to actually bringing, taking the FARC off the table and working more on eradication. There is a minority of those in the Republican delegation who speak frequently with former President Uribe and who is the leading opponent of the peace accord inside Colombia, and who take a much harder line. And they do have a key voice that may be listened to. We don't know how much yet. And then there is a faction of the Democrats who does worry about, and I would put Wola actually in with this, who worry about if the transitional justice part of the peace accord is way too weak on human rights abusers, if it ends up getting implemented in a way that really guarantees impunity, they will withdraw support somewhat as well. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where things stand right
and
now.
And other than Norway, are there any other international donors that are stepping up to the plate to help Colombia through this process?
There are. Norway, the Swedes have been quite generous. There's a World Bank Fund, an IDB fund. I hope I'm not leaving anybody out. The European Union has
GIZ,
a fund as well.
The German Development Agency, right, has alternative livelihoods focused on preserving forests, but it's not very large, obviously.
Right, so nothing really that would...
See, if you took all foreign donors and put them together, it would be very, very roughly about as large as the U.S. contribution for Colombia.
Right, okay, just to get a sense of the scale and proportion. Banda.
Ted's state presence, the core, the Gordian knot and the cracks to getting everything... The Colombian government has made conscious efforts to expand state presence, and they often emphasized it already in the consolidation plan. So Colombian officials would speak about how now there is a policeman present or two policemen present in every municipio. Often it was two policemen present in municipio of the size of Delaware. So it critically, implications for what that meant. Colombia suffers from the same problem here that Mexico suffers, and that was very different in Thailand. The area is very large, and you have a democratic country that puts pressures on. There is a program to give $7,000. Everyone wants that $7,000. Why does Macarena, which is closer, qualify more than some area in Magdalena Media? Politically, that's very hard to justify, and the political pressure is to give everyone a little bit, which is how increasing state presence has been handled, with an official coming in, hey, municipio, you are cleared from the FARC. Wonderful. What do you want? We want a clinic. Here goes a clinic. What do you want? We want a bridge. Here goes a bridge. Which is politically makes sense, and one could argue that there is even some ethical normative precept for giving everyone something. The outcome, of course, is that state presence might increase, but it's increasing in ways that don't generate transformative effects. And so the state has put in two police officers, devoted as they might be, there now might be a bridge, but the community's basic existence on a daily basis still takes place outside of the state and under the worst circumstances with the presence of other armed actors. The Colombian government is negotiating with the ELN. The negotiations have been stalling, halting, but they have more formally took off since February. I think both the Santos administration and the ELN realize that there are many reasons to try to nail down the deal before elections in Colombia and before the new administration comes in. But it's not clear that it will happen. The Colombian government's attitude is essentially to take the basic elements of the process as well as of the outcome from the FARC deal and to impose it on the ELN. We'll see how, you know, how easily that goes. I think that the Santos administration deserves great credit compared to many other Colombian administration about going after the bandas criminales, but it's a big challenge. And the numbers are high, both in the numbers of groups and the numbers of fighters. Some of them, like the Urabeños, are clearly taking on very explicit political agenda elements and political behavior. They are called bandas criminales to distinguish them from the paramilitaries. But in fact, in some cases, it's very clearly an effort to control local municipalities and to have political negotiations point. And so the government's been going after them, but it's a challenge. They have not rolled back the numbers. They have not reduced significantly the number of the groups. They continue to be a key problem. And we'll see what happens with the FARC. At what point, you know, there are allegations of already a number of Frentes defecting. Those might be too strong, but clearly at least elements of Frentes are twitching it a bit. And there are allegations that Brazilian crime groups like the PCC are trying to hire FARC Frentes. I tried to get some real evidence behind them, and I was told that there isn't, that the claims are vastly ahead of what is actual data for them, but certainly it's a plausibility. So my view is that increasing state presence will again have to come in through concentrating resources and thinking about what are the core areas where resources need to be concentrated and where state presence needs to be anchored and where the basic relationship between citizens and state gets changed. And the hope is, of course, that those will gradually expand. Right, but I say it knowing that Colombia has tried. There were 13 strategic zones, 8 strategic zones, 17 strategic zones, and they never panned out. There are precedents and they haven't worked. And I am even more concerned about 2018 in Colombia than in the U.S. and the cuts in USAID. But if Mr. Uribe or Uribista gets elected, they might well decide that state presence means much more aerial spraying. And they might well get a big jump in aid from Trump administration going into exactly the wrong way to signal state presence. So, we might nominally be increasing state presence and yet eradicating the very possibility of peace and the very possibility of a meaningful state presence for years to come.
Yeah, so some real storm clouds on the horizon depending on how things evolve.
A few points about data. Now, I don't know the entire story about why the ATOM program was cut in 2003. I mean, as I said, at its height, there were, covered about 40 different counties throughout the United States, mostly big urban counties. There were plans to expand it to 75. It was cut during the Bush administration, but then ONDCP knew that this was an important data set to have, and so they were able to cobble up enough money together to do it for 10 counties for a certain amount of time, but then they knew that the money was going to run out, so then they only focused on 5. I just think there's only so much money, especially within ONDCP, to spend on data, and they try to keep it alive for as long as possible. That said, I think there, not just ONDCP, but you can imagine a number of other agencies kind of all pooling money together to try to bring this back. This isn't just a justice data set. You can include questions about healthcare utilization. One could imagine creating some type of system where you'd have rotating modules where different agencies could put money into it. Because this is a population that needs a lot of help. And so you can imagine there are a lot of different agencies that want to get information from these individuals. So I do think that there's some way that we could combine public funds as well as money from philanthropic organizations to kind of bring this back. And yes, it would provide information about what's kind of happening in our drug markets and kind of help us get a better understanding of what people are using. You know, for example, fentanyl. You know, we might be able to.
Is there a Colombia connection to fentanyl, or is it just something that's added along the way?
No, China and India.
Yeah, that's coming. Although I mean, it is prescribed here in the United States.
Right, but in terms of the lacing.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's coming from fentanyl that's produced in Asia and then brought over. Yeah.
And often dealers seem to appear to do it without users being informed, which is a very stupid approach to being a dealer.
Yeah.
Because then you lose a lot of your customers.
Yeah.
But so that seems to be happening on the street here.
Yeah.
Any other points?
With respect to global demand, you know, as I was talking about that big drop between 2006, 2010, you know, some people really like to focus on the supply side. Those that weren't as excited about supply side interventions would talk about that it might have been increased demand in Brazil, Argentina, and Europe. I'm not sure what's happened in terms of total consumption in those places. I do believe that it might have gone up in Africa, but it's really hard to get information on that. I mean, you're lucky if some of these countries will do a prevalence survey. But as I said, the people that are driving the market, they're usually not going to be in your general population surveys. I mean, I think in the short run, they do yield some information. But what you really want to pay attention to is kind of what's happening with price. So as I said, when we talked about that 2006 to 2010 drop here in the United States, at the same time, there was a 40% increase in the purity-adjusted price for cocaine in the United States. Meaning that even though, like I said, maybe there was some type of perfect storm, because of there being such a large increase, it's hard to say something didn't happen on the supply side. That said, the last time those price data were updated was 2012. So, I mean, the data are there. It's just a matter of taking an algorithm and then just applying it to data from the DEA's database from retrieving information from drug seizures and undercover buys. This isn't hard to do, and it's not that expensive. But right now, we really don't have any idea what's happening with the purity-adjusted prices between 2013 and 2017. And this is something that wouldn't be hard to do. And one could imagine, if you're trying to get a better understanding of kind of what's happening in different places, prevalent surveys have a little bit of information, but what you'd really want to pay attention to is kind of what's happening with price.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. We have some time for questions, about 20 minutes. Why don't we take three at a time, and I see hand right here in the second row, and there's a microphone coming. If you could identify yourself and give us your question and move around the room.
Yeah, I'm June Beidel from the Congressional Research Service. So Adam and Vanda, the other 50,000 hectares, which is going to be forced manual, correct? I want to know, what is it realistic? Because you said, Vanda, that you said you didn't think the whole thing was, but you focused on the alternative development or the voluntary side. Because as I figure it, between 9 and 12, they were spraying about 100,000 hectares a year till it went down in 13 after the shoot down. So that was a lot. And then to have that taken away, I mean, Adam, you were definitely someone saying, do something, but really, something really wasn't done for the years of the negotiations. So, I mean, I think it's a great idea to say, well, manual was a factor in bringing it down, but it's a big variable to always have had aerial being higher for all those years.
Let's take a couple more. Right behind you.
Thank you. This is a question for Mr. Kilmer. I'm a physician, public health physician from Colombia, actually. Do you think that the investment that the United States has been doing in prevention of cocaine use and opioid use and drug addiction, it's enough? And would that part of the demand, if the demand goes down, do you think that would positively affect my country?
Okay, one more over here on the right-hand side. My right-hand side.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Channing May. I'm with Global Financial Integrity. The UNODC estimates that globally 40% of heroin and cocaine is seized, while less than 1% of drug proceeds are ever recovered. As long as criminal and armed groups are able to receive the overwhelming majority of proceeds, particularly through trade-based money laundering in Colombia and Latin America, combating drug trafficking will be very difficult. In regards to this, the peace accord focuses heavily on the products and participants, as well as the Colombian government, the U.S. government, and most other governments. But what is the Colombian government doing to stop the illicit financial flows?
Great. Good question. So money, aerial eradication impact, manual, and prevention strategies. Who wants to go first, Adam?
Sure. I'm not completely up to date, but I think as of the end of February, the Colombia had claimed to have already eradicated 6,000 of the 50,000 target for manual, forced manual, nothing in exchange eradication. And is it realistic to get to 50,000 over the course? Those 6,000 may have been the low-hanging fruit. I share your skepticism that it would be realistic. I mean, In 2008, when the program was new and eradicators went through and eradicated 90,000, that was hard to do. It was very expensive. It required a lot of logistics, and I think they learned a lot about the security needs. I think a lot of people were killed and maimed in the course of that achieving that 90,000, and then it fell off pretty quickly after that peak year. Where are they doing it? I know they're doing a lot of it. This forced along the Pacific coast. And also, they're going to be moving into the fringe along the Ecuador border where you can't eradicate, and they're doing it also in indigenous reserves and national parks. They're using the army a lot more to do the eradication. The army presumably is looking for new missions, yeah. And this is a key one. This means that they may be more able to withstand ambushes, respond to snipers or attacks, but of course that still a lot of these fields that they may be dealing with have landmines and things like that. The one thing they're doing is using the same herbicide that they were using from aircraft, but using it directly from backpacks, which you can't argue that they're using it as indiscriminately as an airplane flying 100, 200 feet ahead would. And also a lot of Colombian farmers use the same herbicide. There's still a lot of controversy over glyphosate that I won't get into very much, other than to note that California's environmental department has just recommended stopping its use also. But the big thing that you're going to see if they really get close to that 50,000 limit is just more and more conflict. Episodes perhaps of out-and-out violence with communities that have gotten more and more organized in trying to stop, blockade the coca eradicators. We've seen some of that so far, but usually in areas where people were also signing agreements and saying, hey, why are you doing this? We just signed an agreement. In the areas where there's more forcible eradication, it's just bound to happen as we get closer and closer to, if they actually manage to get closer and closer to the 30,000 limit. The illicit financial flows point is a key question. I don't have great information, maybe some of my other partners do. I know that the annual U.S. report on global financial flows, global money laundering, the State Department report, has been a bit more critical of Colombia lately, but still considers Colombia to be sort of above average, which may be low average in terms of dealing with the problem. Most of the big transshipment money nowadays is in Mexico, of course, and it's a much more urgent issue there.
Yeah, let me start with the money. Look, Colombia is the model country in terms of anti-money laundering legislation. It has been since the early 1990s. It has done very little to stop illicit financial flows to Colombia. Perhaps much less goes through the banking sector than in the days of Pablo Escobar. But there are a ton of other ways to get the dirty money in. You already talked about trade-based, which is one of the most convenient. There are very many other mechanisms. Chasing illicit money is often the silver bullet that's put out for by you have sort of set of silver bullets. One is the magical herbicide that will persist in the soil and know exactly what to target and what exactly to avoid. And chasing dirty money is the other one that is all the time put forth. It's never stopped drug flows. It's never defunded one single country. After a lot of effort, the most successful case has been U.S. going after Al-Qaeda money when Al-Qaeda money was heavily in legal businesses. Once it moved out of legal businesses as a result of U.S. anti-money laundering efforts, the level of financial flows to Al-Qaeda also increased. Oftentimes, the interdiction rate is in the single digit for financial flow, so much lower than interdicting the physical goods. Are there ways to make it more effective? perhaps as long as lots of the flows go through the legal system, through the legal banking system, they still go regularly. 2 years ago, major case against several banks laundering, very large banks laundering Mexican cartel money, perhaps knowing it. But once it goes out of the banking systems, it becomes much, much higher. So I will not hold my breath that we will change the behavior of criminal groups or even eliminate criminal groups by resolving the bullet. I think the resolving the silver bullet of chasing dirty money. I hope to be proved wrong. I agree 50,000 hectares, enormously ambitious agenda. The only way I think it could be realized, well, two ways it could be realized. One is to kind of replicate the Taliban, Myanmar policies of 2000 and 1990, so be very brutal. I don't think the Colombian government has the capacity to do that or should do that, or if for some reason there was no resistance to that manual eradication. I don't think that the FARC can ask farmers to do that. Anyway, there would be a lot of areas that are contested by other groups. So, if for some reason farmers are just intimidated right now or disorganized right now, but even if that happens in year one, farmers will go back to cultivating, and I think they'll be more organized subsequently. And on the use of the herbicide from backpacks, just want to point out that what slows down production most is pulling out the bush. If the bush is merely sprayed, then there is quite a bit of time, no matter of hours, that you can prune the bush or wash it off and it survives. And so one of the reasons why you see new coca, Adam, one is people planting in anticipation for getting money. But it's replanting bushes that had been pulled out manually, right, which takes much more, much longer for it to regrow than when it is sprayed and washed off or pruned.
Okay.
All right. And one comment on the data that you asked about the U.S. doing more on prevention and reducing demand. Well, a lot of coke goes to Europe. A lot of coke goes to Brazil and Argentina. And Brazil and Argentina have not been willing to disclose prevalence use since 2005.
Wow.
And there is a lot of suspicion on the grapevine that their prevalence use is on par or greater than the U.S. So it's not just a matter of U.S. using its demand as much as we need to do it, but much bigger problem these days.
Yeah. And I'd say with respect to prevention and treatment, the ACA definitely has increased the availability of treatments, especially medication treatments for those that are suffering from opioid use disorders. But that said, I mean, there still is a tremendous amount of demand for treatment here in the United States for both opioids and cocaine and for methamphetamines. A lot of people end up in treatment in the United States kind of via the criminal justice system. And in some place, we've got, almost 3,000 special or problem-solving courts. About half of them are drug courts. And there were, for a while, a number of drug courts that were really focused on abstinence. And in that, so if you came in addicted, suffering from a heroin use disorder, access to methadone and buprenorphine wasn't allowed. I think that's beginning to change. And in fact, that's one of the things that was done in 2015. Essentially, the director of ONDCP and some others made it very clear that if you're a drug court and you're going to receive federal funding from the United States, you have to allow for the medication-assisted treatment. So I think that is going to make a difference.
But that's only for opiates. We don't have an
equivalent. So that's the issue. When it comes to treatment, we've got the medications that can help, for those that are suffering from opioid use disorders. We don't have those for cocaine. We don't have those for methamphetamine. So then treatment largely relies either on kind of long-term residential cognitive behavioral therapies. And some of these can make a difference, but, there's no silver bullet there. And also, when you begin thinking about those in the criminal justice system who are committing crimes that are related to their substance use, drug courts are not the only option there. There are other options in terms of the kind of swift, certain, fair, and frequent tests, essentially saying you need to be sober. You can go to treatment if you want. So you don't necessarily have to mandate that. And that's worked in some places. That hasn't worked in some others. That seems, in some circles, that gets to be controversial because they think it's juxtaposed to decriminalization. In terms of decriminalizing possession, but you could actually imagine a world where you could decriminalize possession. So if you get caught with certain amounts of heroin, cocaine, you know, you wouldn't necessarily get a criminal offense, but you still could have some of these interventions targeted at those whose use is leading them to, you know, kind of threaten public safety. At that point, when you begin committing crimes, then it's in society's best interest to get that person to reduce their consumption. And for some people, treatment will help. Not everyone needs treatment. In order, even some heavy users are able to cut back on their own. And so we'd love to live in this world where there was free, great treatment for everyone. That's not the world we live in. It's a scarce resource. So if we're going to be putting people in the treatment through the criminal justice system, we need to be smart about this. You know, a lot of these diversion programs will put people into kind of subpar treatment, which isn't very good. Seems like what we need to do is we need to get better about putting people, you know, figuring out which people actually need treatment, so then that way we can concentrate the resources on them.
So we have time for a very short round of questions. Please keep it very brief. I see two hands in the back, and then this one here on the right.
Thank you. Richard Downey from Delphi Strategic Consulting, and thanks for a terrific discussion. Adam and Vonda, you both mentioned the fact that the next presidential elections in Colombia could absolutely derail what's going on with the peace program right now. And I wonder, there's still a couple of years off, but within our own U.S. Congress, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how much support you see for the current program versus those who might be supportive of the Uribe and the opposition approach. Thank you.
Yeah, behind you, yeah.
San Jose Institute for Policy Studies. One of the topics that gets left out of these conversations is the role of poppy in Colombia. And Plan Colombia was originally sold as a way of attacking coca and poppy. Can you give a little thumbnail about what's going on in the status of poppy eradication? And if it's successful in Colombia to any meaningful degree, or if the Trump wall actually stops a lot of the heroin from coming into this country, which I doubt it will, but what would then happen? Is it not predictable what would happen to the fentanyl adulteration crisis in this country? Would it not be, lead to more and greater adulteration by traffickers trying to stretch the profits by adulterating the remaining supplies of fentanyl, leading to a spike in overdose?
Question here on the, yes.
Hi, I'm Eric Waller. Thank you for your presentation. I'm an international business and policy student at Georgetown. Question, how many seats does FARC occupy at the table? And is there a plan in place once you start to eradicate the Hectors, when the drug dealers come out and they start to realize they're losing their money and losing their business, so people won't get hurt, especially Colombians won't be killed or hurt?
Yeah, okay. And we're going to take one last one right here in the front row, but very briefly, and you guys just have to answer what you can in the remaining few minutes.
Okay. I'm Francisco Tumi, a member of the International Narcotics Control Board nominated by Colombia. In what Adam and Vanda said, basically, there's a prescription to have the state gain control of a territory and basically have presence, the presence of a modern state. All these programs seem to be an effort to have state creation from the top down, except that we might use FARC to generate a state from the bottom up. Now, in Colombia, there are many small movements from the grassroots that are trying to generate true democracy from the bottom up, not from the top down. If you do it from the top down, there's no money enough to buy the loyalty of the coca growers. So I wonder if there is a if we can try to bring in some prescriptions, some policy prescriptions to change that, to go from the bottom up.
Okay. Those are great questions. We'll see what we can do in the remaining few minutes. You want to go back in the other?
I'll just speak about fentanyl. Fentanyl is scary and it's cheap. And so when we begin thinking about the consequences of various interventions, whether it be in the United States or outside of the United States, we need to think about fentanyl supply routes and what that could actually mean. Because as I said before, when people would talk about it, it was mixed with opioids. But now you're hearing about it being mixed with cocaine. So this is from a public health perspective, you know, in terms of surveillance, this is going to be very important. But also in terms of when we do our policy analyses, we now have to factor fentanyl in.
Okay.
I would very much endorse that. Both spoke about the scarcity of treatment, that is inevitably also scarcity of law enforcement. And rarely does law enforcement think about if this drug, this route is oppressed, what will happen. In my view, the clear priority is to get as much fentanyl off the market as possible, and that should be prioritization in how we structure broadly law enforcement and discourage dealers, including through selective enforcement of mixing fentanyl. So I think we might well be facing a situation where organic heroin might be better than something heavily saturated with fentanyl just to save lives. Sanyo, poppy in Colombia. So I looked at it quite in detail a good number of years ago. Poppy was always a marginal crop. It was less prevalent, far, far less prevalent than coca. Adam is whispering 10,000 hectares and far less prevalent even than marijuana. Marijuana, I think, is the sort of more interesting crop that there is experimentation, including with the legal program, like legal medical marijuana program. Nariño was one of the areas where poppy was cultivated, it was one of the early crops to be suppressed much earlier than the coca numbers went down, poppy went down. I don't think that Colombia is a good candidate to having really big resurgence of poppy. Mexico has many advantages. A lot of poppy is being cultivated in Guatemala. There is a lot more potential for Guatemala. We don't quite know a lot about these numbers. But my suspicion is that it was going to remain, regardless of the wall, which is a waste of taxpayers' money, poppy will be flowing to the U.S., or heroin will be flowing to the U.S., from Mexico, Central America, perhaps more from Afghanistan. The Afghanistan supply is still very marginal. We get only about 10%. Maybe that number is slightly going up. But I don't think that's Colombia's future very much at all. And Francisco, I would just endorse, if there is community mobilization to create municipalities with inclusive organization and state that is acceptable, let's put money in that. Donors should put money in that. The United States should put money in that. I would hate to see state formation that is captured in the bag by either vested interest in places like Cauca or Bandas Criminales. But to the extent that they are legitimate, have inclusiveness, fantastic.
Great.
To Rich Downey's question, if a right populist government takes over next year in 2018, I won't say Uri Vista, just right-wing populist, and they're very pro-U.S., and they want to share they want to push the priority of de-emphasizing the peace accords, fumigating and increasing the sort of hardline anti-drug policy, they will have, there will be elements in certainly the Trump administration and in the Congressional Republican Party who will go along with that, especially if they're pro-U.S., pro-free enterprise. I think you would, however, see the end of the bipartisan support for the U.S. policy toward Colombia. I don't think the Democratic Party will go along with it. And if the Democratic Party gains seats in 2018, that would really split the approach in a way that is hard to even understand right now. And finally, just on Francisco's, that was a very good question. In terms of bottom-up movements, helping to create the state, that is sort of foreseen in Chapter 2 of the Accords, which expands political participation in a way as never before. Again, on paper, if implemented as on paper, it would really introduce that element in a way that it has never been before. But what it will also set up is, at the local level all around the country, competition, perhaps violent competition, between these new movements and the traditional landholding, political boss, mafia class, and how that plays out could be violent in some areas.
And Vonda gets the final word.
I just want to alert you to two riveting papers by Bo and Adam on our website. They get into what we talked about, very Wolf reading. Eventually they'll be mine, but meanwhile you can really get into details of what they spoke about, Brookings website, Adam and Bo.
Excellent, great. Well, this has been a terrific discussion. Thank you all for coming.